Necessary being, what does that mean then? The only kind of being a necessary being can create is a contingent being. It can't create a non-being. The non-being doesn't be. So it can only create a contingent being. Therein is the doctrine of creation and the doctrine of analogy all in one. You must be different from God because you're contingent. You must be similar to God because you're being. God can't create a non-being. So the act of the principle of finality doesn't mean that every agent produces another agent identical to itself. It just simply produces something similar to itself.
Is this principle saying that being must produce being?
No, it's not saying it must. If it produces anything, it must produce something like itself, not totally different and not identical.
This principle seems dependent or a branch of causality.
It is. In fact, all these principles should sound like they're interchangeable and interdependent and manifestations of, because you can start at the horse or start at the cart and you can get at it different ways. So it is. It's a principle of causality looking forward instead of the principle of causality looking backward. Instead of starting with an effect and looking back to what produced it, you're starting with a cause and looking forward to what it's producing. So the principle of finality is the principle of causality going forward. Is being an attribute? That, of course, is a long, complicated question that arises particularly after Immanuel Kant, when he critiqued the ontological argument because he said being is used as an attribute or a predicate. And the answer to that is no, being is not an attribute. Being is that of which all attributes are predicatable. But being itself is not an attribute. Being is the reality of which all attributes are predicatable. If you have some reality, then you can call it this or that kind of reality and predicate things of it. It's a tall reality, it's a short one, it's a green one, it's a fat one. But you have to have some reality there for the predicate to really stick. So when we're talking about being, we are not talking about it as an attribute of something. We're talking about it as the something of which things are the attributes.
But it sounds like an attribute to me when we say that God is
okay, does this sound like an attribute to you if I say, I am I? Does it sound like I'm predicating I-ness of myself, or does it sound like I'm simply affirming a self-identity that is there? See, I would argue that I am I, that I is not predicating an attribute of me, that I is affirming my basic I-ness. So in that sense, being is not an attribute. Being can be a predicate, can stand in the predicative position. You know, tree is green and green is the predicate. I'm talking about logically now. The tree is green in logic. Tree is a subject and green is the predicate, and is the copula in logic. Now, it can stand in the predicate position. God is being. But only because there's an identity between beingness and God. Everything else has being, and it has it in a certain mode. So what we are attributing to man is a certain mode of being. We're not attributing certain characteristics to that mode. All right, let's take a look at the next point, priority among first principles. We have five basic first principles. I'm arguing that these are the fundamental, self-evident, irreducible, whatever you'd like to describe them, first principles, that beyond which not. And is there a priority? That is, which principle is first among the first principles, if any? All the foregoing principles may be said to be first principles. The question now is, which principle is first among the first? As Thomas said, not every principle is a first principle. Nevertheless, it must be observed that a principle of movement may happen to be first in a genus, but not first absolutely. That is why all of the first principles are first relatively. Only one can be first absolutely. Before a determination is made as to which principle is first among first, qualifications for this high honor must be examined. One, the necessary characteristic of an absolutely first principle. As Aristotle defined it, the most certain principle of all is that about which it is impossible to be mistaken. For such a one must be the most well-known and not assumed. Hence, he first sets down three conditions for the strongest principle. One, the first is that about this no one can lie or err. Second, is that it be not conditional. Third, Aristotle said, is that it be not acquired by demonstration or in another like manner, but that it come as if by nature to the one having it, as it be known naturally and not by acquisition. Sullivan summarizes the essential qualifications of an absolutely first principle as follows. First principles, then, cannot be particular judgments of sense, but are rather the most general judgments conceivable and the most evident, which presuppose no other in the same order for their proof, and are implicit in every judgment. I'll take the two parts of that definition. An absolutely first principle would presuppose nothing else in its order. There would be nothing behind it, beyond it, beneath it. It would presuppose nothing else. And, secondly, and or, that principle would be implied in every judgment you made in that order. If it's really a first principle, it's implied in every judgment you make, and there can't be anything behind it. Now, which of all of the principles would fit in that category? Well, some people say a candidate would be the principle of identity. And this is argued by Jacques Maritain, for example, contending the principle of identity is first, and the principle of contradiction is only a negative form of it. The reason usually offered in defense of the primacy of identity is that the positive must precede the negative. It's argued that the mind has first a conception of being, and the first and most basic judgment is that being is being, which is an assertion of identity. So Maritain's argument would go like this. The most fundamental thing you can say is being. You can then say non-being is not being. That's the principle of non-contradiction. But the principle of identity says being is being. I am I. You can say I am not you. That would be the principle of non-contradiction. But I am I is more fundamental than I am not you. That's Maritain's argument. Others object to this, contending that it confuses the order of judgment and the order of concepts. The mind has a concept of being first, and the next concept must be of non-being, since that is all that's left. The first judgment, however, must be of the relation between being and non-being, which is one of contradiction and not identity. In short, the positive is prior to the negative only in the sense that the concept of the negative presupposes a concept of the positive, not in the sense that a positive judgment must precede a negative one. Now, this is a real tricky debate among philosophers. Let me just try and simplify it a little bit for you. If apprehension is the most fundamental thing in the order of knowing, then it would seem like the principle of identity is the most fundamental principle. If judgment is the most fundamental thing in the order of knowing, making a predication, making an assertion, then it would seem like the principle of non-contradiction is the most fundamental. And I don't want to resolve that now. I'll just tell you which side I come down on. I come down on the judgment side. And it seems to me that the people who work out of an idealistic Platonic concept generally tend to think identity is the most fundamental principle, and the people who work out of a more empirical Aristotelian context think that the principle of non-contradiction is most fundamental. So without making an ultimate defense of either the a priori starting point where identity would be more fundamental or the a posteriori starting point where contradiction would be more fundamental, I simply say that I favor the latter for the same reasons that Aquinas and Aristotle did, that all knowledge begins in the senses. You don't come into the world first with a bubbling storehouse of ideas and a consciousness of your own identity and then suddenly recognize that something is different from. You form your own identity by negating others of yourself and form a self-consciousness by saying, I am not my dad, I am not my mother, I am not the table, I am not the doll, and you form that by judgments. Now, if that is true, if that's the way we come to know, then the principle of non-contradiction is more fundamental than the principle of identity for us on the bottom here. For God on the top, the principle of identity is the most fundamental, because he doesn't have to wait for a world out there to know that he exists. He knows in and of himself that he exists and that he's identical with himself. So for a self-existing being like God, the principle of identity would be the most fundamental one. I am I. And that's what he affirmed to Moses. I am that I am. But for a being like us, I think I am not you, I am not that. I think judgments that differentiate happen to be more epistemologically fundamental than the self-identity principle. Sullivan says, as to the priority of the principles, the principle of contradiction is the only one which is absolutely first in the sense of the definition of first principles. The principle of identity and excluded middle are aspects of or derived by immediate inference from the principle of non-contradiction. The principle of sufficient reason is derived from it by demonstration, he says. Principle of causality is deduced from the principle of sufficient reason, he argues. The principles of relational logic are immediately evident from an inspection of their terms. They may be regarded as restricted applications of the supreme rule of being, the principle of non-contradiction. The same may be said for the principle of any of the special sciences, except where these principles are the conclusion of prior sciences. Another way of showing the superiority of contradiction as the first principle, and I like this way, is by showing that it is the basis of the other principles, but the reverse is not true. Now, for a human being, which of necessity must think in abstractions, the principle of contradiction is prior to that of identity. For an angel, an intuitive intelligence that does not need to abstract, this is Aquinas' view of angels, identity is prior to contradiction. Regi sums up the reason for this. It could be said that for an intuitive intelligence, angels, the truth of the principle of identity would precede that of the principle of contradiction, because intuitive vision of being would reveal its existential actuality determined by a positive essence, quiddity, whose interior, indivisible, and undivided riches would in a way exaggerate it and oppose it to everything else. But our abstract minds, human beings down here on earth, whose feeble light fragments the real and can only unify it only by an intermediation of many comparisons, this is why the truth of the principle of identity can be defended by the truth of the principle of contradiction, but the inverse is not possible. According to Sullivan, those scholastic philosophers who contend for the primacy of identity over contradiction use quotations from St. Thomas favoring the primacy of the principle of contradiction to confirm their contentions and maintain that it is the same thing as the principle of identity. And Sullivan traces the influence of the primacy of identity among philosophers back through various people, and we need not go into that. He concludes, Finally then, it may be asked, since the principle of contradiction is the only principle which is strictly first, why these other principles have been treated at all? It's because they also may be called first principles, not indeed in the sense that no principle is prior to them, but in the sense that each is first as the source of that particular branch of human knowledge at the head of which it stands. So it's legitimately called a first principle because in that order, the order of finality, the principle of finality is first. In the order of causality, the principle of causality is first. But the principle that is first among all the first is the principle of contradiction, because none of those principles could be so if it weren't true that a thing cannot, that the principle of contradiction applied. Well, let's take them one by one. Why is it that being cannot be being if the principle... Why is it this principle can't be true? Being is being if the principle of non-contradiction doesn't hold.
Being like non-being.
Then being might be non-being.
Well,
See, the principle of identity says being is being. In order for that to be true, the principle of contradiction would have to hold, otherwise being could possibly be non-being. And if being could possibly be non-being, then being doesn't necessarily have to be being. A is only necessarily true if it's impossible that A could be non-A. But that's the principle of non-contradiction. A can't be non-A. So unless the principle of non-contradiction were true, the principle of identity couldn't be true. Anybody not see that? This is the summary of the whole point here.
This might be naive statement, but it seems to be the possibility that we have to realize identity and non-contradiction simultaneously.
No, it's not impossible. And in one sense, it's true. If you look at it from the top side and bottom side, that they're simultaneously true, because there is a sense in which the principle of non-contradiction couldn't be true if the principle of identity weren't true also. Because if being weren't being and non-being weren't non-being, then you couldn't say being is not non-being, because being might be non-being. So it depends on whether you're looking at the top side or the bottom side. The flip side of the subject will be the same. They are kind of interrelated, inseparably interrelated principles. And that's the point I'm trying to make here. That they're all first principles. You can't go beyond them. And you can't get along without them. And you don't presuppose anything beneath them. That they are literally first in their order. And each has a different application. I want to make one important distinction. Alvin Plantinga and people who criticize foundationalism, and this is a foundationalist epistemology as opposed to a coherentist, usually say that one of the problems is that it is deductive, that what you have is a whole set of first principles from which you're deducing everything else. And I think they're making a mistake, because while there are deductive foundationalists, Aquinas wouldn't be one. Spinoza would be an example of one. Spinoza, or perhaps Descartes. And as we've often said, the problem with him is he got Descartes before the horse anyway. Deductive first principles, where you have axioms like Euclid and you deduce everything else from it. Aquinas, I think, would be called a reductive first principle epistemologist. And by that, we mean that all true knowledge is ultimately dependent on, reducible to, some first principles. Not deducible from, like a sponge you can squeeze it out of, but like a foundation, something you can fall back on. That when people press you, sooner or later you got to get back to first principles. If they say, how do you know that? How do you know that? How do you know that? You can't go on asking, how do you know that forever? That's an infinite regress. No one would ever know then. If you borrow $10 from me, you can't say, he has it, he has it, he has it, he has it. Sooner or later, somebody has to come up with the 10 bucks. Well, now, you reduce it, you trace it back, rather than deduce it from. Another way to put it is, I don't think Aquinas really believes that you can take a look at all subjects and deduce from them what the predicate of a sentence will be. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. I think what he means is you can take a look at all predicates and discover what the subject will be. Let me give an example. He doesn't say, take a look at a cause and you'll automatically know what follows from it. That you'll automatically be able to deduce the effect from the cause. Because simply because God can cause doesn't mean he is going to cause. So you can't take a look at God, a necessary, infinite, eternal being, and deduce from that what he's going to do. But you can take a look at an effect and reduce from that what the cause must have done to produce it. So if you take a look at an effect, you see here's a contingent, finite world. You say, now what are the necessary conditions for producing a contingent, finite world? It would be, ultimately you're going to have to get back to an infinite, non-contingent, necessary being as the basis for that, the necessary, sufficient condition. So I think what Aquinas is talking about is a reductive study the predicate and you can understand the subject, not a deductive study the subject and you can always deduce the predicate from it. Now you can in some cases. In And sometimes his definition sounds like that. If you study the predicate, all husbands, I mean the subject, all husbands, you can deduce from that what the predicate will be. Are married men. But it doesn't always work that way. It's not always. Sometimes you have to take a good look at the predicate, like every contingent thing has a cause. You can't look at cause and deduce that it's going to be producing a contingent thing. But you can look at effect and reduce that there must have been a cause from it. Am I communicating this point? It's an important difference between modern rationalists. Both of these are foundationalists in their epistemology. But it's an important difference between two kinds of foundationalists. And the present critique of foundationalism by Plantinga and Waltersdorf and the whole Reform group, strongly centered in Notre Dame and in the Christian philosophical circles, is built on attacking the straw man. They're assuming that all foundationalists are deductive. They give their arguments against deductive foundationalism, but they don't touch reductive foundationalism, which is another kind, nor what you might call transcendental foundationalists, like Van Til, a la Knutson's interpretation we talked about last time, who are saying it's transcendentally necessary to postulate certain things as a foundation for knowledge, or you couldn't have this knowledge. Same thing Kant is doing in his first critique. Any questions or comments on this objective way of defending first principles by reduction or by transcendental reduction? Well, the reduction wouldn't necessarily have to be transcendental, whereas all transcendental arguments are reductionistic. Not all reductionistic arguments are transcendental.
The ones that aren't transcendental
would be causal. See, transcendental means necessary condition, where causal means necessary and sufficient condition. A necessary condition for leaves burning is that they're dry. Necessary and sufficient condition is that they're dry and you have a match. Necessary and sufficient condition means cause. Necessary condition just means necessary condition. Anything else on that? One other way to state it is that first principles are literally undeniable. They're actually undeniable. Now, by that we don't mean that nobody's ever denied them. Anytime you name something as undeniable, you'll find somebody that'll deny it. We mean that while people can say, I don't believe in the law of non-contradiction, they can't actually affirm it without using it. So it's actually undeniable, though not formally undeniable. Well, they can formally say, I don't believe in the law of non-contradiction. And one of the ways to test for a first principle is find out if it is deniable without using it. Sooner or later, somebody's going to ask you for the criteria for a first principle. Well, one of the criteria is it's self-evident. Look at the predicate and see if it's reducible to the subject. Another criteria would be try and deny it without using it. If you can't deny it without using it, it's pretty basic. It's basic, undeniable law of thought. And that's true of the law of non-contradiction, identity, excluded middle, and all of the basic laws of logic, of all being, and the principle of causality is true of finite being. Sooner or later, when you try and explain a finite being without saying it has a cause, you're going to have something that could not be, but is, without a cause. But how could it be determined to be when it also could not be unless something determined it to be? If it really has equal indeterminacy of being or not being, there would be no explanation as to why it is rather than is not, unless there were a cause for it. Subjective certitude. The mind must assent to first principles. That's the first point that Aquinas makes. According to St. Thomas, once the terms of first principles are known, the mind must assent to them. He says that assent to first principles is not free. You don't have any choice about whether, once your mind understands the law of non-contradiction, your mind doesn't have any free choice as to whether to accept it. Your mind is forced to accept it once it understands it. Now, the assent of science is not subject to free choice because the knower is obliged to assent by the force of the demonstration. Another place he says that assent is natural, if therefore that which the reason apprehends is such that it naturally assents thereto, for example, first principles. It is not in our power to assent to it or to dissent, for in such cases assent follows naturally, and consequently, properly speaking, is not the subject of our command. In fact, Aquinas even speaks of a natural unconscious inclination of the intellect to truth, a kind of instinct for truth. Now, for those of you who are working on law or first principles, Aquinas calls this in the moral realm synderesis. Synderesis, S-Y-N-D-E-R, is the natural inclination of human beings toward the moral law. And there is a natural inclination in the mind toward rational first principles, and there's a natural inclination in the heart toward moral first principles like do good and shun evil. And that's the basis for the natural law. What Roman Catholics call natural law, and you and I have been prone to call general revelation or the law written on their hearts, Romans 2, 12 through 14. And there's an interesting parallel here. Just as the mind leans naturally toward rational first principles, so the heart leans naturally toward moral first principles. The mind can distort first principles, and the heart can distort first principles, but there is a natural inclination. You are born with an instinct for truth, a synderesis, a bend, an inclination, a propensity. Use any of those terms you like. It's the same thing Augustine said about depravity. You are born with the necessity to die and the propensity to sin. You are born with the propensity toward truth. For truth is the intellect's good and the term of its natural inclination. And just as things without knowledge are moved toward their end without knowing it, so sometimes does the human intellect by a natural inclination tend toward truth, although it does not perceive its nature. Another way to put that, and the way I like to put it best, is that you know things by inclination before you know them by cognition. So you say, well, I just intuitively know that's wrong. Why do you intuitively know that's wrong? Because you know things by inclination before you know them by cognition. Before you think about it and rationalize about it, you just naturally tend that. Why? Because God built you that way. Man is built in such a direction, Imago Dei, that he bends naturally toward first principles of truth and first principles of action, all intellectual and moral, respectively. The reason for this natural predisposition of truth is as follows. Everything that comes from God receives from him a certain nature by which it is related to its final end. It's also true that every power has a natural appetite with respect to its proper good. And with the exception of the will, all the powers of the soul are necessitated by their object. Now, why does he have to say that? With the exception of the will, the proper object of any power you have, the mind to truth, the heart to good, or whatever, the proper object always necessitates you in that direction with the exception of the will. There wouldn't be any freedom of the will if that were so. So the natural object of the will does not necessitate choice. If it did, we would be unfree. Certitude about first principles, then, comes from the fact that the intellect is naturally determined to the truth, and man is not free to dissent. The reason the mind must dissent to them is that they are reducible to the principle of non-contradiction, to which the mind cannot dissent. The first principle of all assent is stated as a modal proposition. On the other hand, all other immediate assent imply the first assent, and mediate assent can only exist only insofar as they can be reduced to the principle of non-contradiction, in his Hermeneutics, Lecture 6. Now, certitude and assent differ. Certitude is always accompanied by assent. That is, the mind always assents to propositions that are certain. However, assent is not always accompanied by certitude. One may assent to something as being only probable and not necessary. In the case of man's everyday life, in the business affairs of men, there is no such thing as demonstrative and infallible proof, and we must be content with a certain conjectural probability, such as that which an orator employs to persuade. One may also assent to the conclusion of a probable induction, but not with certitude. For he who proceeds inductively through singulars to universal does not demonstrate or does he construct a necessarily conclusive syllogism?